Are companies like Amazon a monopoly? Well, after years of ducking the question, while European regulators mostly said yes, Congress has decided it's ready to take a second look at Amazon, Apple, Google, and Facebook. For a look back at how these tech giants today compared to the industrial monopolies of old, we're going to be speaking now with historians Brian Ballow and Nathan Connolly, their co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Welcome back to the show, guys.
Hey, Peter.
Hey, Peter.
Hey, so Brian, I know you're a historian. Forgive me for asking you to start this conversation by defining an economic term, monopoly, just so we know what we're all working with here.
Well, Peter, it's this board game, and you get paper, fake money. I declare the top hat. I just want to be clear about
it. I was asking for that.
Well, it is good to start with a definition. And today, the Federal Trade Commission, which regulates antitrust policy for the United States, defines a monopoly as a corporation's long-term ability to raise prices or exclude competitors. And the emphasis there is on long term. You know, it's okay to raise prices, but if a corporation controls so much of a market that it can raise prices without facing competition, that raises all kinds of red flags today.
Okay, so we've got that out of the way. Nathan, the next question is for you. Well, what were the first monopolies in the United States?
Well, before the Civil War, many states in the country depended on monopolies to do the kinds of things that governments simply could not. So companies with monopoly power would build bridges and turnpikes in the early Republic and in the antebellum period. Banking, for instance, or schooling was done largely by monopoly powers. And the idea, at least, was that these monopolies were advancing what was called a kind of unified common good. Mm-hmm. And many company charters, you know, in terms of them being agreements with governments, were supposed to then set the terms for that public good. Good. And in that spirit, I think, you know, just thinking about the 19th century and how it unfolded, many Americans initially felt quite comfortable with what became one of the most polarizing monopoly powers in American history, and that's the railroads.
Right. The railroads, an industry that transformed 19th century America, certainly transformed for sure the Western United States, and I think you could argue transformed the global economy and America's position in the world.
Absolutely. The railroads changed the way Americans thought about monopolies. There had always been a public good associated with monopolies, as Nathan was talking about, but they also began to create enormous inequalities of wealth, and the men who ran those railroads became associated with that huge wealth gap. You think of people like Cornelius Vanderbilt or Jay Gould. They not only made millions and lived on roads called places like Millionaire's Road, they also displayed their wealth conspicuously. And if you were a poorly paid worker working for another growing corporation, let's say U.S. Steel, you had to take note of your working conditions, what you were being paid, and what these titans of industry were making and the way that they were living. Also, those railroads picked winners and losers. Where they decided to build the rails could really make or break a community. Those railroads, to make matters worse in the public view, were heavily subsidized by state, local government. It's estimated that the railroads received over 100 million acres in, quote, federal lands. It should be noted that a lot of those lands
Native
were territory,
American
and they were Native American lands, so the federal government have felt free in giving them out. Again, that helped the nation develop its economy, but it certainly did that at a very, very high price. Finally, I talked about communities winning and losing. There were actually other businesses, even corporations, that could win or lose based on the deals that they cut with railroads. And to make matters worse, those deals often were secret. And the monopoly of all monopolies, Standard Oil, was one of those emerging corporations that really benefited by the deals that it cut with railroads.
So are you saying that Standard Oil, which was by far the largest petroleum company in the country at that time, that the monopoly of the railroad helped turn Standard Oil into a monopoly?
Well, think about the early founders of that company, right? John D. Rockefeller and Henry Flagler. I mean, these were both men who had existing oil investments and then ultimately discount arrangements with the railroad industry. I mean, Standard Oil was established in 1870, but Rockefeller brought with him into that partnership discounts with the New York Central Railroad, where basically 70% of the cost of freight was going to be knocked off by his friends in the railroad industry. Now, what was interesting about Standard Oil, of course, is that these two men, with their various partners, they worked to ensure that rail discounts and rebates basically propped up Standard Oil in Ohio, and then from there in Pennsylvania, in Maryland. And the idea was, of course, to basically do what monopolies often do, which is to have a kind of horizontal integration, which is purchasing competitors, and then vertical integration, controlling the entire production process from pumping to refining to marketing and then to distribution. And what's so staggering about Standard Oil's growth is that in only 10 years after its founding, its market share went from 4% to 90% of the entire oil market in the country. And critically, and this may surprise some listeners, the price of refined oil actually dropped during this time. So it's not the case that monopoly led to price increases. In fact, it dropped by more than half in the 1870s. But what did define the Standard Oil monopoly was, of course, its political power. It donated, you know, massively to national elections, for instance, undermining the campaign of William Jennings Bryan with what would be the equivalent of a $7.6 million donation to his opposition. And then, of course, at the local level, Standard Oil absolutely crushed its competitors. And what's been called the Cleveland Massacre in just 1 year, Standard Oil gobbled up 22 of its 26 competitors in the state of Ohio alone.
Wow. So is that why Americans started to turn on monopolies, because of what Standard Oil was doing?
Yeah. I mean, Americans going all the way back to the Revolution, Peter, had this thing about really big entities and really distant entities. Mm-hmm. Usually, that hostility was turned towards foreign governments like Great Britain during the Revolution, or the federal government, the United States government. By the end of the 19th century, with corporations like Standard Oil and U.S. Steel, the Meatpackers Trust on the prowl, Americans finally decided that actually government was the lesser of two evils. Only government could begin to tame these gigantic entities that were controlling people's lives. So lots of states began to pass legislation. And in 1890, Congress passed the Sherman Antitrust Act, 50-1 in the Senate and 242 in the House.
But so, if I remember my history correctly, they didn't have much in the way of teeth. It didn't do a lot.
You are absolutely right, Peter, because the problem with the Sherman Act, one was just the definition, which was very hazy, of what is a monopoly, but it required enforcement by the executive branch, and that took a lot of political will that especially was not there from politicians who were getting large donations from large corporations. And it also took the support of the courts, which were pretty political and, as we know today, can remain pretty political. The courts finally did say enough is enough with Standard Oil at the end of the first decade of the 20th century. And in essence, they broke up Standard Oil.
But the interesting thing about Standard Oil is, and you've already mentioned this, that consumers were actually getting a good deal under that monopoly. Oil prices were low. And that's strange to think about, because today we generally consider something a monopoly if it raises prices on consumers because it's anti-competitive.
Well, again, this is the value of history, right, Peter? You have to go back to some of those early debates. Companies like Standard Oil, like Facebook and Google, they still aspire to grow in market share. And that's really more about access of that market, not price, right? I mean, just thinking back to Standard Oil, you had the Supreme Court getting involved, but none of these efforts to break up that company remove the will to grow from that company or any other company, frankly. And that feels to many competitors like a monopoly today.
So, Brian, catch us up now. It's 2019. We've got high-profile Democrats talking about breaking up these companies. And yet we've been talking about these older questions about political influence and big business shaping debates over antitrust today. I mean, what's old is new.
I think that's right to a certain extent, but what's left out in this discussion of break them up or leave it to the free market is what the American government did for most of the period that we're talking about. One of the great moments, if you will, in a more nuanced middle road was the consent decree in the mid-1950s by AT&T. It was sued for antitrust, and God knows it was a gigantic monopoly. But it came up with an agreement that said it was going to license some of its innovations. What was one of those innovations? It was this little thing called the transistor, which became the basis for semiconductors, which became the basis for Silicon Valley. And by forcing AT&T to make that available, collecting royalties by licensing it to places that became Intel eventually, you allowed AT&T to benefit from the kinds of economies of scale and Bell Labs that it enjoyed. At the same time, you didn't lock up those innovations and confine them to one single corporation.
That's Brian Vallow and Nathan Connolly. They're hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Thanks to you both, as always.
Thank you.
Thank you, Peter.